Welcome to a new episode of The Brand Called You. Today I have someone who I would probably call a quintessential entrepreneur, Vineet Gupta. Vineet, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Vineet is from IIT Delhi. He's been an entrepreneur for 25 years. He's the co-founder of Jambori Education. He's also the co-founder of Ashoka University and Plaksha University. So Vineet, tell us a little bit about your early career. Some of your learnings and some of your challenges.
So my first sort of professional foray after graduating in 91, I set up a packaging firm from scratch. So I became an entrepreneur. My dad was in the civil services, but you know, the entrepreneurial calling I think was very strong. So we scaled that business. We became the largest styrofoam manufacturer in the country by 2005. But it was a tough business. Manufacturing is tough, so we sold that. My wife had started Jambori actually, so I had helped her start it. And then in 2005, I had time, so I thought maybe let me try to help her. But as it turned out, she sort of totally withdrew in an year, and I was left running the company, which has been very exciting. So we built Jambori, we scaled that from 3 centers to almost 37 now.
So I'm going to come to Jambori, but tell me, you know, you were one of the few people who went to IIT and then chose to stay in India. What made you take this decision?
Well, I don't think one of the few. I think back in my time, maybe 40% of the class was going abroad.
Okay.
Maybe 50. And to be honest, I had also written my GMAT.
Okay.
And I had an admission to Yale for an MBA.
Right.
But little scholarship, maybe 20-30%, and it's still, the balance 70% was still a sizable amount of money, which there was no way of getting funding to. So as destiny would turn out, I ended up being here. So I had an option to go work for Bharat Electronics, I think the entrepreneurial calling
was much greater. I agree with you. So let's come to Jambori. You know, you were saying that your wife founded it in the 2005, you got associated. Talk to us a little bit about what does Jambori do?
So we help coach students on exams such as the GMAT, GRE, SAT. You know, I had an offer to Yale, I couldn't go. My wife incidentally wrote her SAT and she had admission to Brown. She couldn't go for the same reason because of funding. So, and she's a good teacher. So she started in a garage teaching students. And that's what the company is really. It's high quality coaching and high quality teaching. I think the growth sort of happened from there. And to Akrita's credit, my wife, I think the brand sort of got built around her teaching in the very early years. You know, people used to sort of queue up to learn from her. So my challenge when she decided to exit was, how do we retain that excellence when we scale? From one teacher, we now have almost 200 teachers. So how do you retain that excellence? So we invested in very strong teaching, very strong training. So somebody asked me, what is Jambori? I think more than a student training company, we're actually a teacher training company.
I see.
You know, we pick up very good talent, which is very raw, and we are able to transform them in a year into outstanding teachers. And then our teachers are, you know, very sought after. People would hire anybody who's from Jambori. We don't hire too much from competition, not that we are averse to, but we are equally happy hiring young talent who's raw.
Interesting.
And that, I think, is the potential in this country. You know, sometimes often in education and in higher education, we complain of lack of good quality teachers. But I think there's an opportunity to create. It's no different from creating a company. You creating an excellent cadre of managers or an excellent cadre of IT professionals.
Absolutely. So, you know, you mentioned, I was reading about you, that Jambori changes the support to students in their quest for higher education. Help me understand, what is the kind of support students need and what do you provide?
So, you know, right from clearing the exams, GMAT, GRE, SAT, to finding the right university, helping them figure out scholarships, funding, and visa. So, you know, pretty much end to end, right till the time they board the aircraft and go.
Wow.
So we do that. And I think the gratifying thing for us is, while access for education abroad is always, you know, the wealthier families have greater access. But I think what's been gratifying is that even for people coming from middle class families and people who can't afford, I think there is a way. You know, if a student is determined to go and study abroad, they will find funding, especially if you excel. So I think those stories are far more gratifying. And to open up a great education to a middle class, lower middle class child is very gratifying.
And I'm sure you must be building some fascinating case studies.
Oh yeah,
all these young individuals who are going.
We have outstanding stories.
So one day I'm going to talk to you about those stories.
Sure.
Which you know our audience can listen to.
Sure.
So you know, tell me, you said you're spread across 22 cities with 37 centers, and I'm sure you're growing.
Yeah.
What have been some of your challenges while you were scaling up?
So I think the scale-up challenge was what I described. How do you replicate high-quality teaching? You know, this is, I feel that the business of teaching, if you call it a business, because that's what it is, it is about teaching, right? The brand really gets built around teaching. You know, no amount of marketing gimmicks, nothing works. Mm-hmm. If you are doing a good job, students are getting good results, they are going out and talking well of you, the brand gets built. You falter, you have a strong brand, you falter in a particular center for a year, mm-hmm. and you can see the decline. Mm-hmm. So it's very, very deadly. So that's the big challenge. It's a human-centered business. How do you replicate excellent standards of teaching from one location to 37 locations? So, you know, standardizing content, investing in high-quality teacher training. We really are teacher training. Our teacher training is absolutely very rigorous. You know, we train teachers for 6 months, 1 year. So that has been the big challenge. Of course, in the beginning, scale up, those are also challenges. But those, you know, sort of after you've done 4-5 centers, yeah. you get a hang of it. Now, I think our biggest challenge for us is technology. Okay. You know, technology is redefining the learning experience, right? And the jury is out. Is it going to totally replace the classroom, right? That's the question we are all asking. And so how do we integrate technology to redefine that learning? Eventually, it boils down to the learning experience, right? Earlier, the human was crafting it. Now, technology is playing. So technology is here to stay. It is already redefining learning. You know, look at what you are doing, yeah. right? This is all part of learning,
correct.
Right?
Correct.
Now, so how do we integrate that with our classroom modules? How much technology to bring in? Where does it stop? Does it completely replace the human? I think that for us will define what our business is in the next 10 years.
And you are predominantly brick and mortar, or are you also in
No, online? We are now last 5 years, we've started going online. But online is still maybe 10-15% of our business. But it's growing very rapidly. So we have a strong
eye. And all students who are now coming to you are all millennials.
Yes.
Over the years, how have you seen expectations of students change?
Well, I think fundamentally they don't. They need a good experience. Earlier, what has changed is earlier students would come to the center far more frequently. You know, a large part of their prep was happening in the center. Now, an equally large part is happening at home, right? So, and that's where I talk about. So, I think one expectation that has dramatically changed is, look, we will come to the center only if required. If technology can help deliver the solution, then we'd rather work from home. So, that is fundamentally sort of changing the dynamic of the teaching and education business, if I may say. I think the other is that the students, 25 years ago, there was very little information. Students are extremely well informed. I find that each interaction I have with a student now, I learn something because they'll come up with two more university names, two more courses. And you say, look, I've never heard of this. I've been in this for 25 years. I think they're extremely well informed. So that makes your job. They can Google everything. They can get everything. So I think it's increased. I think you have to be on the top of your game and really go with an interaction saying, look, I'm also going to learn with you. So don't, if I can't answer your question, don't be disappointed. But, you know.
I agree. So, you know, a question I've often wondered, and I'm not directly associated with education, though my wife is a very senior teacher at the American Embassy School. But, you know, every year when I look at college admissions in India, I keep trying to figure out if I was ever to try and give exams, I would never get admitted anywhere. Because the play for the top colleges in India seems to be in some 0.1 or 0.2%. What is that doing to students in India? And is that driving more students overseas?
So, you know, India higher education is a big challenge on two accounts. I think one is access. There's still 1 in 4 students going to college. China and India were similar. We were both were around 8% students going to college at the turn of the century. China is 51%.
Wow.
We are 26, right? So they've sort of... So
what you're saying is we're short of colleges?
We are terribly short of colleges. And so this, if this 1 in 4 has to go to 1 in 2 in the next 10 years, it means we have to double our higher education capacity. So whatever we created in the last 70 years, we have to create in the next 10 years. So huge challenge of capacity, which is the pressure on numbers. Look at how much capacity has gone up in Delhi University, which is something we know, right? That's why you see such terrible competition. And then I think now 65% of higher education in India is in the private sector. And that has, the quality has been suspect. There are some great examples. I mean, you know, we're very proud of what we've done at Ashoka. But I think bulk of the higher education in the country is also private higher ed has been suspect. You know, they've been, so the quality challenge is equally great. And that's why you see people going all over the world. You know, people have access, people are more affluent.
I agree. So one more question on Jamboree before we move to your other interests. You know, GMAT is something which a lot of students take.
Yeah.
And it is a globally accepted standard. We have created our own CAT and MAT. What prevents us from using one standard that is acceptable all over the world?
It's a good question. And we should move down the route. But I think somewhere your earlier question is tied with this.
Mm-hmm.
See, CAT is essentially an exam to eliminate people.
Yeah.
Right? Because you are, I mean, look at the people who get calls from the IIMs. You have to be in the 99 percentile, right? 99.4, 98 percentile, you may not get any call from any of the IIMs, right? So it's a very difficult, so they pack in a lot, compress the time and make it extremely difficult, right? The GMAT is a great exam, very standardized, but it's not as tough, right? So, if everybody who's appearing were to write the GMAT, you'll suddenly find so many scores which are right at the top. So, that elimination process, and same is the case with the IIT JEE, you know, these are exams for elimination because of that stiff competition, right? So, I only think this is that logic. I mean, the other is the more sort of nationalistic logic, which is to say we need our own exams. These are still US-based. Are they testing the competencies that Indian students have? They are also more expensive. Right? Does it provide free access, equitable access? So those are those questions. But yes, I mean, the whole notion of standardized testing, I feel in India is a big issue.
Because we are not even standard across India on our own.
And imagine now what happens if you are a higher education institution. You have students coming from 25 boards of the country. What does it mean to have a 90% in Maharashtra board versus 80% in CBI? You know, so it's a huge, huge challenge. And you know, then you have to be transparent. You're subject to RTI. So, you know, it is standardized testing.
So I sit on the board of the Jaipuria Institute of Management, which has 4 MBA schools. And there seems to be a constant discussion everywhere that, you know, we take MAT, but, you know, should we start taking CAT? If you're taking CAT, what? You know, so it's just too many.
So I think every institution is sort of finding its own way. But yes, the opportunity for standardized testing in India, I mean, you will see this play out in the next 10 years.
So let's move to the next part of our program, which is on startups and entrepreneurship. And we have close to 500,000 people watching our show every month,
right?
You know, and a lot of them are startup entrepreneurs. Right. So you've done, you know, you did your Styrofoam venture, you're in Jamboree, then you're with Ashoka, with Plaksha. Tell me, what is so unique about Plaksha? And then I'll come to Ashoka. That is, you know, a university that seems to be getting a lot of visibility.
Well, I think just to sort of see the motivation behind Plaksha. So, so the world has 2-3 influences going on. One is that technology has become a key enabler. Technology is influencing everything. You know, technology is influencing businesses. Technology is influencing the way we live, the way we live, the way we form relationships, the way we interact. I mean, technology has become sort of the language of the world, right? That's one sort of peg. The second one you see is that engineering, you hear these reports that millions of engineers are graduating. India's graduating 1.3 million engineers. 60% are unemployed, right? So you wonder, look, what's happening? I mean, they're saying technology is really the backbone and driving everything, and you find so many engineers are not finding jobs. So clearly something is broken, right? And what is broken is that we fundamentally believe, all of us who are associated with Plaksha, that engineering education needs reimagination, right? Some institutions are doing a better job, some institutions not so good. But I think engineering education fundamentally needs reimagination. It needs a stronger connect to society. Engineers need to understand problems of and be able to strongly connect with human beings. Rather than be totally focused on how to solve a problem, also understand what problems to solve. So engineers for society sort of is one big mission for Plaksha. So I think that is resonating extremely well. I think the second is really on the skill side. I think two, three skills will dominate.
Okay.
One is sort of the entrepreneurial mindset, right? Not only that you create your own venture, but are you, if you ask any top CEO, who's the ideal person you want to recruit? And, you know, people will often tell you somebody who can not only think about a problem, but also lead that and solve it and form a team. And, you know, so like an entrepreneur within an organization, correct, right? Correct. Somebody who can lead, form, collaborate, you know, take initiative. So more than anything else, I think in today's day and age, this entrepreneurial mindset, entrepreneurial ability, which is a very unique sort of skill set, is I think a key skill. I would rate it right at the top. And linked with that is your design sensibility, understanding to solve problems from a very user perspective, understanding your own self, being able to relate with people extremely well. And it's an, I mean, and you're assuming they are good at their technology and all that is an assumption already. But I think this is really the top order skill. And I think institutions, Plaksha is coming out with this mission on redefining engineering education, connected strongly with society, but also these higher level order skills, right? Which I think is exciting. So let's see how it
plays out. And yet, I asked you this question first about Plaksha, so I'm coming to Ashoka because you've been associated with him since 2008.
Yeah.
And it is one of the finest liberal arts college in this country today.
Yeah.
What makes Ashoka so unique? Or is the thinking behind Ashoka and Plaksha very similar?
Well, I think the institution building principles are very similar. And to answer this question, I think what makes both Ashoka and Plaksha unique is both are great communities of people. I mean, if you look at Ashoka, look at the people who've come together to found it. It's totally selfless, right? Everybody has a day job. Everybody's built great companies. But people are saying, can we build a great institution? And often it takes, to build a great institution, will take the collective energy of 10, 20, 50. Because it's much more difficult, right? Then a great set of people who have a great vision and purity of thought attracts great faculty.
Correct.
And institutions are all about faculty.
Right.
So Ashoka attracted some outstanding faculty who could be teaching anywhere in the world. Great set of people founding it, great faculty, then you attract great students. So you become a great community, and institutions are really about people, you know, so of course then Ashoka built a great campus and we reached out and all of that followed, but it's really a great community. And the second thing I would say is then it came up with a unique pedagogy of learning, right? Breadth. So students learn a variety of things, and then they go into depth. You've been a corporate leader and you would appreciate that. I mean, today in any profession, that breadth of understanding is so important.
Absolutely.
Right. And our curriculum is very depth based. So I think and a focus again on skills like writing, communication, problem solving. You add the right faculty and a great learning environment, and you get Ashoka. So I think Plaksha and institution building principles is absolutely similar. So it's focused on engineering, entrepreneurial ability, solving big problems. But I think the institution founding
similar DNA for both universities.
Absolutely, very, very, very similar.
So let's move on to some questions for us for startups and entrepreneurship. First question I ask a lot of people is it good for a new startup entrepreneur to go solo or with a partner?
It's a difficult question. I think both models work. I think partners definitely help because they bring in very complementing skills and you can do much more. And this takes me back to the point I was making, but I think partnerships also, you need to have the self-realization and the understanding of being able to make relationships click. I think entrepreneurship is so much about people. You know, being able to deal with your partner, being able to deal with your employees, your customers, your investors. So it's entrepreneurship is inherently very, very people intensive. But I do think that a good entrepreneur is able to deal effectively with his or her partner. So I think having a co-partner, having a co-founder, I mean, does give you support. And as long as you can make the relationship work. I mean, that's really the pivot.
Complementarity is very important.
It's outstanding. You know, one and one can be 11. I mean, the only challenge being you have to make the relationship work. So you have to put your, you have to deal with that challenge. But if you are the sort of person who feels, look, I can work alone. Because if that relationship sort of breaks, then you see a lot of bad things happening. You don't want that. So I think if you inherently can make these relationships work, I would go with a partner.
So the next question for you would be, you know, given all your experience with startups, what are some of the, in your opinion, what are some of the basic mistakes a lot of startup entrepreneurs make?
Well, I don't know whether they are mistakes, but you know, one thing I find, so I think entrepreneurs have to build sustainable businesses, right? Businesses have to be sustainable. The products have to be sustainable, good, you know, make good products, good customers, build sustainable businesses. I think the part which I'm unable to unrelate to, which is happening a lot in today's world, I think there is far more, entrepreneurs are chasing valuations, correct, raising money far more. And, you know, you sometimes wonder what's in this organization, right?
I agree.
And that maybe, and there is a method to this, I'm sure, but that is a part of entrepreneurship that I'm not able to totally relate to. So my advice to entrepreneurs always is, you know, it doesn't, you know, whether your company becomes big or small, there is a fair bit of destiny, whether you make a lot of wealth or little wealth, right? But if you build a sustainable company, if you build a sustainable business, you will be happy, right? You'll have a great, you will have fun, you'll have a great organization, you know, you'll have happy customers, and you'll feel your so, you know, invest in the journey. Right. I think that's the part I unrelate to. Entrepreneurs too often, you know, it's you know, the company is still sort of taking ground, and you know, the immediate conversations about valuation and raising money, and you know, so I that is what my advice. I think focus on building a sustainable company.
So I find with a lot of entrepreneurs, even before they have managed to settle and stabilize, they start talking of Pan India. And I often told people that, why do you want to look at Pan India? Just look at Pan Gurgaon, which has got giving you 3 million people. At what stage should a young company start to scale up?
No, I think that's a million-dollar question, Ashutosh. And I can only tell you from my own experience as an entrepreneur. In my packaging firm, which we successfully sold off in 2005, I burnt my hands while scaling up big time, right? We were going from one plants to three plants, and you know, so there was a rough two years of very rough period, and which so I think scale up is a skill,
correct?
Right? I think how you scale up is a skill, which is even if you've been successful as an entrepreneur, you may not be. This is what I learned. You may not be successful in scaling up, right? Because it has lots of moving parts and you have to think about it very differently, and team is at the center of it. So I can't answer this question at what point, but I think every entrepreneur has to. But I am totally with you on that. I think at every point in time, you have to see what is the immediate opportunity for you. If you can't cater to Gurgaon, why think about India, right? If you can't cater to your neighborhood, and if you've done Gurgaon, maybe look at Delhi. So I think you have to look at your immediate opportunity. Correct. What can you do in the... So even at Jamboree, for example, we are now in four countries, but for a long time we said, look, we've not even covered India. And people would come and ask us, can you open US? Or, you know, and so I think you keep looking at what you are, where you are, and what's the opportunity. Right? And what can you do?
So now I have two more questions left for you, and both of the deal with failure. I have seen that Indians particularly don't like to talk about failure. We keep saying first aana hai, head of the class, somehow, and it manifests itself in our own behavior at traffic light. Somehow or the other, my car must be in front. When a plane lands, somehow or the other, I must be the first to get off the plane. How important is teaching failure to our startup entrepreneurs?
Yeah. So, no, I think good question, Ashu. I mean, entrepreneurship is about failure. Okay. Failure is inherent, right? I mean, at every for every one success, you have two failures. So, failure is going to be inherent in entrepreneurship. I think that is understood. I can't talk of other professions. I've never been in another profession. But what I feel is that what is important to be taught to entrepreneurs is how, I think that's a given, entrepreneurs get it up, but how to deal with failure. You know, I think failures are going to be there, but to deal with failures and learn from them versus getting bogged down and saying, look, the story's over, right? I think failures have to be taken as lessons, but entrepreneurs also need to develop the resilience to be able to come out of it. And often how they come out of those failures is really going to define how successful entrepreneurs become. Or
right. So my last question to you, which is, you know, and I ask this from all my guests, because all the people who listen to us somehow just believe that successful people don't have failures.
Right.
So my question to you is, what has been your learnings from some of your failures?
So, I mean, the first one I just alluded to, you know, when we were scaling up our pharma, this packaging venture, you know, we had some tough time. And for 5 years, I had become averse to expansion, you know, because I started thinking, look, I can't scale up, right? So that's the sort of impact it had on me, right? Till one day I was in a sort of a transformation course, and it occurred to me, this is a conversation and I need to change it. And then it started to, I mean, and then you started looking, what will it take? What does expansion take? I mean, what teams do you need to have and what structures you, you know, so I think this whole scale up has been a big failure for me early on, and to come out of it. And, you know, I think that's been a big one. I think the second is really, the importance of, I don't think I paid too much attention to relationships very early on when I was building businesses, whether it was customers or my own people. And you gradually realize that entrepreneurship is all about people, right? So I think developing your own capacity. So in the last 15 years, I think that's where a bulk of my effort goes. Developing my own capacity to be with people and to be able to, you know, organize. That whole transformation in relationships, I think, is a huge, it can be very, very powerful. And that's been the second one.
Vinny, thank you very much. I sincerely hope to see Jamboree, not just in 4 countries, but in all countries across the world. I wish you lots of success. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Brand Called You podcast. Be sure to visit tbcy.in to join the conversation, access show notes, and discover fantastic bonus content. You can follow us on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Simply search for The Brand Called You. Thank you, and see you next week.